Hello and welcome to the Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society event titled, With Decision, Separation of Conjoined Twins in Halakha. We would like to dedicate this lecture series to the memory of the 8 brave and precious Jews that were tragically murdered in the recent attack in Merkaz HaRav, Jerusalem. May the learning we accomplish tonight be le'iluyei nishmatam. I'm delighted to see that all of you were able to attend this most anticipated event. My name is David Harari, and I am a board member of the Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society. The YU Medical Ethics Society is a student-run organization with the goal of promoting education and awareness of medical ethics at YU and in the global community at large. While increasing sensitivity to the ethical issues in medicine that are relevant to all mankind, MES is especially focused on issues of medical ethics in relation to halakha, Jewish law, and Torah values. MES strives to make Yeshiva University a global center for Jewish medical ethics, which will serve as an educational resource for laymen, rabbis, patients, doctors, and all other healthcare professionals. We encourage all those people interested in becoming involved with the society and or wish to be updated with future events and news to please sign up on the listserv at the table and should be pages passed around as well. Firstly, I would like to thank my co-chairman for this event, Michael Plow, whose diligent work and dedication to every technicality made this event possible. Special thank you to the president of the Medical Ethics Society, Aaron Kogut, whose late-night organizational skills, care for the very fine details, and steadfast determination cannot be matched. Thank you to our medical and rabbinic advisor, Rabbi Dr. Edward Reichman, a man who loves Torah, medicine, and the world of medical ethics. His insight and advice are invaluable. Many thanks to all my fellow board members at the Wilf and Barron campuses and to all the volunteers who helped out. I would like to share my appreciation for our sponsors, the Center for the Jewish Future, the Student Organization of Yeshiva, the Yeshiva Student Council, the Yeshiva College Student Council, and Stern College for Women Student Council. On a more personal note, I would like to thank my father for coming and my wife for attending as well. I would like to thank our cherished speakers and lecturers, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, Dr. Gerard Weinberg, and Mr. David Wasserman, who have graciously given up their time to share their depth and breadth of knowledge and their expertise in this field. I will talk more about our noted speakers in just a moment. Although a rare phenomenon estimated to range between 1 in 50,000 and 1 in 200,000 births, conjoined twins, or more informally, Siamese twins, are familiar to us in one form or another. From Chang and Eng Bunker, born in Siam in the 1800s, hence the term Siamese twins, to the famous decision concerning the conjoined baby A and baby B twins that stirred the rabbinic and medical world in the 1970s. To popular conjoined twins such as the Hensel twins featured on Oprah and Life magazine, we should be no strangers to these occurrences. Obviously, the surgical separation of conjoined twins, whether it be of the parent's own volition or medically dictated, calls into question tremendous ethical and medical concerns, moral concerns, touching upon the very core foundations of life and death. In the instance of baby A and baby B, a decision that was ultimately brought forth to the Torah giant Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, a pioneering science and medical writer, Donald C. Drake, recalled, "For all, it was a time of the most intense self-examination. No other surgery can more dramatically demonstrate the growing number of moral and ethical dilemmas confronting the medical profession as science extends its control over life and death." Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler quoted Dr. C. Everett Koop, once chief of surgery at the Philadelphia Children's Hospital and known for presiding over the separation of baby A and baby B in 1977. Dr. Koop turned to his anxious and impatient staff at the time and remarked, "The ethics and morals involved in this decision are too complex for me. I believe they are too complex for you as well. Therefore, I referred it to an old rabbi in the Lower East Side of New York, Rabbi Feinstein. He is a great scholar, a saintly individual. He knows how to answer such questions. When he tells me, I too will know. Likewise, these critical matters are far beyond me. It is my pleasure to leave the podium now and hand over the floor to the real experts in halakha, medicine, and ethics. We are joined tonight by Rabbi Daniel Feldman, Dr. Gerard Weinberg, and Mr. David Wasserman. I will introduce all the speakers now, and we will then have the privilege to hear from them in the session. Please feel free to stay after the talk for a brief question and answer session." Dr. Gerard Weinberg graduated the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University in 1973 and stayed on as a surgical resident before beginning to study pediatric surgery at the University of Miami with Dr. Mark Rowe. After an appointment as attending pediatric surgeon at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem and Rambam Hospital in Haifa, Israel, he rejoined Dr. Rowe on the faculty of the University of Pittsburgh in the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. Arriving in the Bronx in 1982, Dr. Weinberg pursued special interest in neonatal surgery at Weiler and trauma surgery at Jacoby Medical Center. He is board certified in pediatric surgery and is listed in Best Doctors in New York. He is a professor of clinical surgery and pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and clinical director at the Children's Hospital in Montefiore. He has special interest in newborn surgery and the treatment of vascular lesions in children. Mr. David Wasserman, JD, is director of research at the Center for Ethics at Yeshiva University. Before joining the university in 2007, Mr. Wasserman was a research scholar at the Institute for Philosophy and Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He has held research fellowships at Harvard and NYU and received research support from the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Science Foundation. He works on issues in genetics, disability, reproduction, and research ethics. Among many other publications and numerous articles, Mr. Wasserman co-authored a book on disability, diligence, disability difference and discrimination, and co-edited Quality of Life and Human Difference, Genetic Testing, Healthcare, and Disability. In the 2001 winter volume of the Philosophy and Public Policy Quarterly, published by the University of Maryland, Mr. Wasserman authored the article titled, Killing Mary to Save Jody, Conjoined Twins and Individual Rights. You could find this in the packet being provided. So, Daniel Feldman is a Magid Shiur in the Stone Beit Midrash program at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Feldman serves as Director of Rabbinic Research at the Center for Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. He is the author of The Right and the Good, Halakha and Human Relations, author of three books in Hebrew titled Binat HaSefarim, and co-editor of six volumes of Talmudic essays. Rabbi Feldman earned his Rabbinic degree from Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University and is a graduate of the Western Hillel Elyon. Kindly please turn off all your cell phones and patiently hold your questions until the end of the lecture. The source packets distributed tonight contain many valuable sources on this topic and are for your keeping. It is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Gerard Weinberg.
Thank you, Mr. Harari. I'm glad you read that little biography. What you didn't describe in your biography is the fact that before I went to Albert Einstein for medical school, I was a student right here in YU, both in the at the high school across the street, and I think the last time I was probably in room 501 in Belfer Hall was probably 1969, probably in the spring of 1969, where I took some now long-forgotten final exam. I'm glad to say I passed the exam and I graduated YU. The room hasn't changed much. The floor is the same as it was 39 years ago. I think the chairs look different. Otherwise, YU is YU. I'm privileged to be able to speak on conjoined twins. I know something about them. I'm a pediatric surgeon, and a couple of years ago, we in Montefiore had the opportunity to work on a pair of conjoined twins, and some of the slides that I will show you this afternoon or this evening were given to me by Dr. James Goodrich, who's director of pediatric neurosurgery at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and was one of the people who was on the team that worked on separating the twins. So it's something that is not only of historic significance, but is also something which is quite relevant right here in the year 2008. Conjoined twins, and I think that Mr. Harwright discussed it, are basically identical twins, monozygotic twins, that have not properly split after fertilization. They then go on to share a body, and may share even vital organs. If you all know your embryology, identical twins are created from a single fertilized egg. Normally, the egg will start separating into a blastocyst and will separate within 12 days. If the egg does not separate completely, instead of having two separate embryos, the two embryos will remain attached, causing the babies to grow into one another. This is a very, very unusual condition. If you think about the routine stuff that we see in pediatric surgery, we're talking usually cases that measure 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000. Something which occurs 1 in 3, 4,000 live births is considered unusual. The abnormalities of the heart, abnormalities of the trachea, of the esophagus. More routine common things such as pyloric stenosis occur in 1 in 2 to 300 babies. These kind of twins are exceptionally rare. Monozygotic gottic twins. Okay. Identical twins occur approximately 4 in 1,000 live births. That's assuming the mother has not taken fertility agents. Dizygotic or fraternal twins occur about 3 times as often, about 10 to 15,000 per live birth. Conjoined twins, depending on the literature you read, occur approximately 1 in 50,000 live births. Most of them are stillborn. Only about half of them will go on to survive one day. And finally, about a quarter of these babies will die in utero. This is a picture of a set of twins. You can see they're joined. They had shared one heart, one central circulation. They're both intubated. They die on the second day postpartum. For many, many years, conjoined twins were noted to be something abnormal. Depending on the culture that these twins were born, they were either ostracized or condemned. Many of the Near Eastern religions felt that these kind of twins were a manifestation of God's wrath and were a punishment that God visited on the parents for some sins they committed. If you look at some of the antiquities in Greece, Rome, and Turkey, there are even statues of some of these abnormal twins that are found even in today's museums. In our own society, even as late as the 1800s, they were felt to be abnormal creatures and had a large role to play in some of the circus sideshows. Certainly P.T. Barnum made a lot of money on displaying some of his abnormalities and some of his abnormal twins. If you look at some of the literature, some of the early written literature, you'll find these kind of cranial figures images in very, very early on. This is one set that I found in a manuscript in 1495 from Worms describing what now would be called a craniopagus twin, where they are joined at the head. The oldest published case is in 1495. This is a set of twins. One lived to age 10, and one died. The other twin died 1 hour later, and again, this is felt to be part of God's displeasure at parents and perhaps society in general. In 1500, surgeons started suffering these twins. What was very, very striking was that most of the time, either one twin survived a short time or both of the twins died quickly after the surgery. The first successful operation for separating craniopagus twins was actually in 1952 by Dr. Grosser. And again, only one survived. If you look at a more modern literature, in 1964, there were 3 separations, and again, the mortality was very, very high, a 50% mortality. A many manuscripts showing different kinds of twins, and this is from a manuscript published in Jena in the year, I think it was 1645. Okay, P.T. Barnum was not the first individual to put these people in circuses. These are circus images back in the 1600s and finally in the more modern 1800s. This is a craniopagus parasubicus. Instead of having 2 complete twins, we have one full baby and then the head of a second baby attached by the head to the first baby. These are the Siamese twins that Mr. Raleigh discussed. This is Ang and Cheng Bunker. They were born in Siam in 1811. Hence the term Siamese twins. They were joined with a band just at the level of the umbilicus. And became circus performers for P.T. Barnum. There's a picture of the extended Bunker family. What people don't know is that the Bunkers actually did quite well. the separation, the band attaching to it, is actually quite small, and by today's surgical techniques, the separation would have been very, very easy to perform. Okay. Of more interest is the fact that, in spite of the fact that they were totally fused together, they actually maintained two separate households, the Litton Farms, 1.5 miles apart, and they worked out a schedule that they each spent about 3 to 4 days per week at each farm. And even more intriguing is that each were married, one had 10 children, and the other had 12 children. Go figure. Okay. In 1874, okay, at age 63, one of the twins developed bronchitis and died a couple days later, and his twin died 2 hours thereafter. And this kind of quick successive death is something which is striking in the literature, and people really don't understand it completely. It's felt as due to the abnormalities and the changes in the circulation that occur when one twin passes. What itself happens is that as soon as the first twin dies, there's a tremendous flow of blood into the dead twin, causing the demise of the more healthy one. Even animals have conjoined twinning. And we see a couple pictures here from saber-toothed tigers, which obviously is a little bit old. And finally, we have our little cows here, where Siamese cows from Niagara Falls. Okay, real pictures. The classification of the conjoined twins nowadays is really determined by where the twins are joined or how the twins are joined. And there have been a number of different types in the last century, but what is the common terminology now is the Picus term, which in Greek means fixed. So Philopicus twins are joined at the chest, Amphilopicus are joined at the abdomen, Pygopicus at the sacrum. The most common kind that we see, at least the ones that have survived, are the Craniopagus twins that are joined at the head. About 2% of these twins are joined at the head in the skull, and the problem is not the skull, but the fact that they can share portions of the brain and the blood circulation of the brain. They can be joined either at the top of the head, at the back of the head, or finally in the sides or in the front of the head. And this is a good example of one which would even be difficult to separate by today's standards, where there's a large union of the two skulls occupying the entire occipital part of the skull, as well as part of the frontal and the parietal skull. You can see for yourself the kinds of twins that we deal with and the kinds of organs that are involved in the separation, which is why even in the modern era, separating them can be a daunting task. The ones that Dr. Koop was dealing with were Thoracoptogus twins, where the heart and part of the GI tract were fused. One of the babies had a normal heart, the other baby only had 2 chambers, which made the survival of both twins absolutely impossible. Okay, for those of you who may have taken embryology here, I had the privilege of taking it with Dr. Rella Tendler. Okay, if you remember this, okay, the zygote becomes a blastocyst. The blastocyst cells, of course, are all totipotent. If it's split during the first 7 days of gestation, we have minor zygotic twins. And finally, if you have incomplete splitting of the blastocyst, the conjoined twins. That's most commonly held theory. The second theory is that if something happens to monozygotic twins, they're separated, but then there's a secondary fusion. Most embryologists today don't believe that this is probably true. Pretty visible. They will survive during infancy or early infancy, but at times they get to be older children, certainly school age, the survival rate is quite low, and finally, very few of them will survive to the 11th birthday, to the 10th birthday, and the second decade of life. Medicine, of course, in the year 2008 has tremendously changed. Even the 30 years since Dr. Koop did his surgery, we have modalities available to us which were not available in the 70s. Of course, he had EKGs, he had chest x-rays, echocardiography was just coming into being, MRA was not heard of, Even CAT scans were very uncommon in the year 2000, in the year 1977. Cardiac catheterization was available then, and certainly something that he used. Nowadays, though, besides the routine EKGs and chest X-rays, we now use MRA. MRA, for those of you who may not know, is a magnetic resonance angiography. It's a way of evaluating the blood vessels without actually having to inject any dye into the arteries. We have liver scans, we have MRIs, and finally, probably the most important thing we can do nowadays is we have this incredible software which lets us do CT scan in three dimensions and couple that with an MRA, and you can get an incredible picture of what is going on underneath the skin without having to do any invasive tests whatsoever. Since the 70s, the chances of survival have improved dramatically. When I was a medical student in the early 70s, it was considered exceptionally rare to be able to operate on a baby who weighed less than 1,500 grams and still have a survival. I can tell you over the last 3 weeks, I've operated on 4 babies, all of whom weighed less than 1,000 grams, and luckily, thankfully, or thank God, all the babies are alive today and actually doing quite well. Having a 600-gram baby survive major surgery, abdominal surgery, or liver surgery, or even open heart surgery, is something which is not science fiction anymore. It's something that we do routinely in major medical centers. Not only can we separate organs such as livers, things that Dr. Krug was unable to do, but we have techniques nowadays that could cover large areas of denuded skin and reduce the risk of infection, which was one of the killers of babies back in the early 60s and 70s. The question we still have is nowadays is when do you operate? What is the ideal time, the optimal time to operate on babies, these conjoined twins? Dr. Koop decided to wait until the babies are a few months old so they could become stronger. Becoming stronger is no longer a major issue. We now have life support systems that are more sophisticated and earlier separation is much more common. And in the unlucky event that one of the twins is stillborn, we can do immediate separation. It is felt by a lot of psychologists, I'm not one of them, I'm not a psychologist, but I certainly think that there's something to be said, that it's probably important to operate on twins when they're still young and not able to realize that they are twins, probably is a better way of managing them rather than waiting until they're a bit older after tremendous separation and anxiety issues that we've seen in the older children. These are pictures of the twins that I was able to work with Dr. Goodrich. These were the Dwyer twins. The Dwyer twins were conjoined twins with craniopagus, joint at the head. They were born in a little village in the Philippines. The mother was a devout church-going lady who contacted some local church charity groups, who then found this nice little blue-haired lady who lived in Connecticut, who made it her life's goal to get these babies out of the Philippines, out of the village, and bring them to the United States where they can have a decent chance of survival. For some reason, she got a hold of Dr. Goodrich, who had been in the Philippines giving a lecture at that time, and she convinced him to be able to bring these babies over to Montefiore and see if anything can be done to separate them. This is Carl and Clarence. You can see they're both alert, awake. One of them is quite large, and the other one is a little bit runcier, which is not uncommon conjoined twins. And this is one of the MRIs that we got on the babies. The major issues we see here, and I don't want to bore you with the details, is that the skull was joined, and there was one very, very large common channel, or venous sinus, that joined the two brains together. And quickly, Dr. Goodrich and Dr. Staffenberg, who was a plastic surgeon, realized that it was not just a matter of separating the skull and separating the brain, but there was also, there had to be some sort of way to deal with very, very large sinuses. The sinuses in the brain, unlike the veins in the periphery, are very thin-walled structures. If you touch them, if you try to suture them, they're going to disintegrate, they will not hold the stitches, they will tear, and the babies will examine them. So what do you do? Where do you draw the line? Where do you break the skull in half? what do you do with a defect in the scalp that's going to resolve, with that's going to result, and finally, how do you manage blood losses and the tremendously unbalanced intratwin sharing of blood, and even the anesthetic agents. And finally, let's not forget, you're going to be dealing with the brain. Besides having the brain, you've also got the fluid, the central spinal fluid, cerebral spinal fluid. That's got to be diverted. That's got to be drained. And finally, there's always the always present danger of infection. Using anatomic models, we worked out the details of the venous and arterial circulation of the babies, again showing these large venules and sinuses. And finally, Dr. Goodrich and I and Dr. Stephanie decided that instead of attempting a 20-30 hour marathon session, we would stage the operation. We would do 3-4 different little operations and slowly divide the twins and try not to do everything in one sitting. And this actually worked out quite well. We managed to separate it. We managed to divide the blood vessels in stages. The large sinus was divided. We first did an anterior approach, separating the front of the skull. And we re-studied it, and you can see that the sinus now is a little more easily manageable. It's not as big as it was. And finally, at a third operation, we were able to divide the back of the skulls and separate the brains completely. The next problem was the problem of how do you cover the bare scalp? And this is something that we have available nowadays, which was not available in the 70s and 80s, and it's these tissue expanders. This is a little silastic bag filled with saline, and it's attached to a piece of tubing. And the tubing is attached to a little port, a little reservoir. And that little reservoir is implanted underneath the skin in the neck or in the chest, wherever it is available. And what the surgeon does is every couple of days, he takes a sterile needle, injects more saline through this reservoir, and fills up this little bag more, so that bag which contains 5 cc's on day 1 can contain 20 cc's in 2 weeks and finally 50 cc's, and what it does is it expands the skin over the bag. So instead of having a little small piece of skin, you now have a large piece of skin, and you can use that skin then to cover large skull and scalp defects. This was done, and we're able to get the entire scalp to cover what was over the area of his joint. This is just before the last operation. Some of the issues that faced us as we took care of these babies were IV access. Easy to get an IV in a big boy or an adult, but certainly in little babies, a little more difficult. Okay. There was crossover of medication from one child to the other. If you give one baby an anesthetic agent, they'll get over to the other baby. If you give food to one child, the other child's going to avoid. And the real problem was that Carl and Clarence, were not identical. One was larger than the other. One had a problem with high blood pressure and needed to be placed on blood pressure medicines. Carl was hypotensive and low blood pressure, so you had real difficulty in adjusting the medication to keep them both in neutral position. This is part of the team. We had 2 sets of anesthesiologists, 2 sets of scrub nurses, 2 sets of surgeons. This is the 2 twins before the very final operation. And finally, they were separated. And I can tell you they now live 2 separate happy lives. They are both in school. I can tell you they no longer live in a dirt house in the Philippines. The mom was a real con artist, and she now has a house in Scarsdale. True story. And both the twins attend private schools in Scarsdale, and they come back to Montefiore every few months for rehab and for routine follow-up. Their scalps have grown completely. They had no sun protection. And they both had little shrugs to drain some of the fluid that accumulates, but I must say they both did quite well and very well adjusted. There are celebrities in the hospital every time they come in. Of course, there's a big team that surrounds them, and they've done quite well. So the issues that we that face us as surgeons when we deal with these contract wounds is that, first of all, is the surgery doable? Is it viable? Can we do the operation? And the tests we have available nowadays are MRIs, 3D graphics. We can decide where the joint is, how large it is, the extent, what internal organs are involved. We can then work out the details with a group of people. We can then look and see if the twins, it looks like the twins are both equally robust and can survive surgery. And quality of life is, of course, an important issue. And I guess from an ethical point of view, I guess Dr. Feldman and Mr. Wasserman have been decided, you know, what are the ethical issues if they are separated versus joined. And finally, the issue of Dr. Kruthen, the Feinstein raised is it proper, is it right to sacrifice one twin to save the life of the other? And I can tell you that the operations at Montefiore cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Just to give you an example, my wife had recent surgery at Montefiore. Her bill for a 3-day stay in the hospital was $32,000. Clarence and Carl were in the hospital for about 8 months. Underwent 4 operations. The bill, I've never seen the bill, but I would not be shocked if it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 million. Finally, the considerations we raise in the hospital are the religious consideration. If the parents know that one twin will die as a result of surgery, they may object. Do you go to a judge to overrule the parent's decision? Do you agree to the parents and let them make the decision for you? Finally, it's important with parents when the children live. If these Aguayo babies had stayed in the Philippines, nothing would have happened. They may have been treated outcast. In Africa, they may have been left outside the village. Finally, what's interesting is that some parents believe that the possibility of separating them, it may not be worth the scarring. And perhaps the twins are better off if they stay stuck together than when they are separated. Okay, I think these are some of the issues that we face as physicians, but something that we as physicians really don't have the ability to decide on our own, and that's the reason we have people like Mr. Wasserman and Dr. Feldman to help us out. Thank you.
I'm David Wasserman, and it's a real honor to be here speaking between Dr. Weinberg and Rabbi Feldman, and I'm going to try to show my appreciation by being fairly brief so that you'll have more time for Rabbi Feldman in your own questions. I'm going to be talking about issues that arise in resolving conflicts, about the separation of conjoined twins in pluralistic societies, in societies where there's no dominant religious authority and where different religious traditions and different personal values can lead the people involved to come to different decisions about they want to do, about what they want to do in cases of the possible separation of conjoined DNAs. There's a whole slew of other issues involving the separation of adult conjoined twins, that tiny fraction of conjoined twins that survive to be able to make those choices themselves, but I think that that's a topic for another occasion. There are really two kinds of conflict that I'm going to be talking about. The first is a conflict in the interest of neonates. There's no issue if separation or non-separation is indisputably better for both. And the second kind of conflict, though, is between the choices or desires of parents and healthcare professionals. There's in Anglo-American law, there's no case unless someone brings it. So even if the parents and the health professionals want what an ethical or religious authority would consider a very bad, make a very bad choice, if they don't disagree, it's not going to come before the courts. So it's not going to be resolved. Now, you can have one kind of conflict without the other. You can have parents or health professionals who push for separation, even though there are real questions about whether it's in the twins' best interests, or who are reluctant to attempt surgery, even if it's the only option for both twins, the only life-saving option for both twins. And you can also have, and you can certainly have cases in which everyone's agreed, there's a consensus among the affected people, but they're wrong. Of course, identifying those cases is going to be a contentious business. But I'll be focusing cases where both kinds of conflict are present, where it's the twins themselves have at least somewhat conflicting interests, and I'll describe those kind of conflicts in a minute, but also where the people who normally make decisions, the parents and the doctors, have some kind of disagreement in turn to the courts. And although I'm focusing on those, I just want to note that whether the interests of conjoined twins, conjoined neonates conflict, can itself be a matter of disagreement. In one of the cases I'll be talking about, where separation would have brought about almost instant death to one of the twins, this is the case of the Maltese twins in England, the most recent of the three most well-publicized recent cases. In that case, the lower court, the first court to address the issue, held that it was in the best interest of that twin, who was certain to die very quickly after separation, to be separated because there was no point in her continued existence. And that itself was rejected by almost all the other judges in the case, although they disagreed on a great deal else. It's also possible that separation will be thought to be in the interests of conjoined twins, despite considerable risks, in part because of the difficulty of imagining how a decent life can be lived conjoined. And there are often compelling reasons for separation, but we have to be a bit skeptical of the desire to separate when there's very little understanding of how it's possible to live a good life conjoined. And obviously in most of the cases we're talking about here, most of the cases that have of neonatal separation that have aroused controversy, there's very little possibility of long-term survival, let alone flourishing. But that issue can arise. So there are really two types of, and this is not a medical distinction, but there are two types of conflicting interest cases. One of them is where separation, I call them symmetrical embodiment cases. And the Lakewood case was not quite that kind of case because the twins had different hearts. There was a later case involving the same hospital, somewhat confusingly called the Lake Bird case, in which there was a single heart, and I believe a single liver shared by both twins, and they were sort of symmetrically embodied. There was very little to sort of choose between them, no obvious way to allocate organs. The decision was made simply on the basis of the surgeon's hunch about which twin had the better shot of survival. The other kind of case is a case where the organs and the two twins differ in viability. And this is where a lot of interesting conflicts arise, where both twins can survive for some period of time, but usually not very long, if they're not separated. If they're separated, one is virtually certain to die, and the other may, live significantly longer, perhaps not a normal lifespan, but many more years than she would otherwise have. And it's easy to see how people can differ about these kinds of cases. in the case, in the Lakewood case, both the parent and the doctors, I think somewhat unusually, didn't adopt an adversarial stance. They sought religious counsel, and you'll hear more about that. And the religious counsel they received was consistent, I believe. But in the later case of the Maltese ones, Jody and Marie, that I've written about, parents brought the children to England because of, you know, the greater medical expertise of British hospitals in giving birth to and sustaining conjoined twins, but decided that once the twins were born, they wanted them to stay together. They opposed surgical separation. And in that case, the hospital strongly, and the health professionals involved strongly favored separation because both twins were going to die, although how soon they were going to die was a somewhat uncertain and elastic judgment. The initial estimates were a matter of weeks. By the time the case was resolved, it was a matter of years. But one of the twins, Jody, looked like she could survive indefinitely if the twins were separated. Most of the organs, the vital organs, were in her side of the body. She had apparently more advanced cognitive functioning. Some of this is speculative, or was at the time, because these are neonates and it's hard to tell how they'll develop. Marie was conscious, but looked like she didn't have nearly as much potential for cognitive development, for independent movement, even if they were to somehow survive. And it was fairly clear that the only feasible surgery to separate them would bring about her death quite soon, and give Jody, the more viable twin, the more the twin with the greater apparent potential, at least a significant chance of living a long life. And this case was a very, very sad case because the parents fought very hard to prevent the separation. The court eventually, the British, I believe House of Lords, I'm a little weak on British jurisprudence, ruled that the twins would be separated. They were, and as predicted, the less viable twin died within an hour or so of separation. The other twin, I believe, is still alive and doing more or less as well as expected, although I think she may have reverted to obscurity now that the case is out of the limelight. So, but one of the questions is, in cases like this, cases where there's conflict both in the interest or the perceived interests of the neonates and among the people who normally decide how to proceed, who makes the decision? Now, one possibility is, the three obvious possibilities are the health professionals, the parents, or the courts. Now, health professionals, as Dr. Weinberg suggested, really are the appropriate decision makers here because they don't have any personal stake in the matter, and they aren't trained to, they don't have any special training to make the kind of judgments involved. They're critical in assessing the prospects of the twins, the difficulties of surgery, but in making these hard choices, they have no special expertise. Parents are the obvious decision makers, and but there aren't the same reasons for deferring to parents that there are in a lot of other choices that affect their children's welfare. First of all, the parents don't have any special knowledge of the children's interests and needs. Now, the parents of the Maltese twins claim that they have some appreciation of them, some sense of their needs in some inchoate sense. I mean, these were small children who even with normal development couldn't talk, couldn't express themselves, had no sense of self-identity, but and certainly the parents didn't have the rich, particularized knowledge of these children and their needs that parents have of older children. A second reason why parental authority wasn't as clear in this case was that this isn't the kind of choice that's clearly within the scope of family privacy and autonomy. Since the children are in the hospital, they need high-tech assistance, and they never become members of a household. And a third reason is that yet not since Roman times, and parents had generally recognized rights of life and death over their children. The closest they came was in cases of severely disabled neonates, and in the 1980s and 90s in this country, that authority was severely curtailed. Parents can't choose death for severely impaired neonates in all but the most extreme circumstances. But the one reason for giving parental preferences and values considerable weight is that the parents have to live with the consequences. These are their children. At least one of the children is likely to die. They will play a role in raising the other children. They have to deal with the enormous psychological consequences of a separation in which one twin dies and the other survives. Their whole sense of themselves as parents and caregivers is implicated in the choice. So it seems clear that even though this isn't the usual case of parental autonomy, of deferring to the parents in their own privileged sphere, that parents' feelings, values, preferences should be given considerable weight. But ultimately, the courts have to make the decision that's brought before them, but it's terribly hard in all these cases. And I just want to quickly run through some of the reasons why it's hard. First of all, Anglo-American law shares with Jewish traditions, which you're going to hear much more about, a commitment to the equal worth of lives. But the length of life, at least when the differences are sufficiently great, may be a more legitimate consideration than quality of life. Anglo-American law does not permit the involuntary sacrifice of one individual to save another. But the question is whether this separation in these cases of asymmetrical embodiment should be seen as sacrificing one twin to save the other. Anglo-American law is also more reluctant to permit harmful actions than omissions, but it makes an exception in cases of self-defense. But when it makes that exception, typically only for intentional or reckless aggression. It rarely deals with cases where aggression, if it can be construed as such, is totally blameless and involuntary. And finally, Anglo-American law treats accelerating death, even by an instant, as killing. And if two people shoot someone, and the second shooter accelerates the person's death by only a second, that person is guilty of murder under Anglo-American law. But perhaps in these very exceptional circumstances, an exception should be made where a loss of days, weeks, or even months is offset by a gain of many years. And there are at least three ways in which the courts related to these difficulties in making a decision. There are at least three ways in which the courts could construe the conflict of these asymmetrically embodied neonates, where separation will or may permit the indefinite survival of one, but accelerate the death of the other. The first way is to see the vital organs that will keep the one alive as belonging to both twins, regardless of their location in their conjoined body, so that one is effectively cannibalized to save the other. And that's the view of some disability advocates. That may have been the view of the parents in the case of the Maltese twins. There's a kind of intermediate view which regards the organs as not belonging to either one in particular, but sees the more viable twin as chosen because of its greater expected longevity of quality of life, and sees that as troublesome because we generally don't choose among lives because we think one has greater length or quality than another. But again, perhaps we do in cases of extreme disparities in length. And the third view, and the view which prevailed in the Maltese Falcon case, although at least in one of the judge's opinions, was that the vital organs really belong to the twin on whose side they are. That in these cases of asymmetrical embodiment, it's fairly easy to draw a line and say these organs belong to Jody, these functioning organs belong to Jody, these atrophy organs belong to Marie. And to see the less viable twin as essentially threatening the more viable twin by a life-threatening appropriation of those organs, and to view separation as protecting the more viable twin against this intrusion. And whether or not this is a reasonable interpretation, it at least saves the courts from having to make judgments about quality of life. But the question, which is very difficult to answer, and certainly very difficult to answer for an Anglo-American court, is which interpretation, which of these three interpretations is the right one? How do we decide? Is there a fact of the matter? You know, is it really anatomy that makes the decision for us? Why should it? Secular courts can't see the will of God in the arrangement of organs. They can't make decisions by invoking the will of God. They can't, however much judges may be influenced by their individual religious faith, but they have to decide on the interpretation. So anyway, to conclude, these are cases in which there are these two kinds of conflicts are going to remain terribly difficult. They can only be helped by the kind of careful ethical analysis that can come both from non-religious and religious ethicists. But ultimately, these are going to remain hard cases. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Dr. Weinberg and Mr. Wasserman for their presentation. And I'd like to thank the Medical Ethics Society for organizing this event. I'd like to thank Yeshiva as a whole. I agree with Dr. Weinberg that it's good to be back. I haven't been in this building in several hours, and it hasn't changed that much. But it is a unique factor of Yeshiva University that we can have an event like this where we get to address an issue from multiple perspectives, from an interdisciplinary sense, but also as far as the yeshiva community as a whole, the collaborative wisdom of this institution is something that we continue to benefit from. I just know from my experience with this lecture, seeing what happens when there's a fine advertising that you're going to speak about something, so then you see people come and present themselves to you, volunteering information, useful facts, useful ideas, and I'm very grateful for that, and I'd like to specifically mentioned by Dr. Eddie Reichman, whose hand I can discern in this packet that we were given out tonight, as well as by Michael Cavus and many others who have shared their edifying thought on this topic. As Dr. Koop said and as David said, these topics are beyond them and they're beyond me. I can only try to survey a little bit some of what has been presented about this issue. It's, of course, a very, very painful one, and it's one in which we look to guidance of precedent and of history and of analysis and of Chachma as a whole, to try to get some type of an insight. And as far as Talmudic literature and early halachic literature is concerned, there is quite a bit to say about the topic of conjoined twins in general, even though the questions that we're really focusing on tonight, the question of separation through surgical methods, was not really discussed in that literature because, as Dr. Weinberg pointed out, it wasn't successfully performed until 1952. This wasn't an issue that the early halachic literature was taking up. And while the early literature was talking about such a reality, it was mostly addressing the question of detailed halakhic questions that would come up, a lot of them revolving around the question of are we dealing with one person or are we dealing with two people. The Gemara tells us in the Sefer Menachos that someone named Palimbo came up to Yehuda HaNasi, the editor of the Mishnayot, and asked him what would the story be as far as the laws of tefillin. If somebody had two heads, would he have to wear two pairs of tefillin? And the Talmud tells us that Yehuda HaNasi didn't really relate to this as a real question. He thought the person was joking around. He didn't think such a thing existed. And he began to rebuke him, and immediately somebody came forward and said that his wife had just given birth to a two-headed baby, and he wasn't sure what the law should be as far as Kijun HaBen. He had to give five tefillin to a kohen, to a priest, in order to redeem the son. If the son had two heads, what should the law be? And clearly it was a real case. And therefore, this change of Yehuda HaNasi's perspective on this, and there really were incidences that are documented from the time that it was shown and on, even though the Tosfos on the side of the page felt that this was not an actual case, it was more of a hypothetical. Tosfos apparently not aware of the cases that had been documented at that time. Tosfos refers to Midrashim, which involved such incidences in more mystically oriented context. And the Shita Mekubetzis, the commentary, again, a Rishon commentary to Menachos, discusses a medrash where Shlomo HaMelech, or King Solomon, was confronted with the case of a two-headed individual, and he wanted to figure out, as far as inheritance is concerned, is this two children or is this one child? Is this someone who gets two portions or gets one portion? And he figured it out by covering the head of one and inflicting pain upon the head of the other. And then when he realized that they both felt the pain, so he ruled that they were apparently one person, and that was where he adjudicated that case. And the Shita Mekubetzis commenting on this, so therefore by bringing this proof to our attention, is apparently making the point that if there are different nervous systems, if there are different sensations between the two, then perhaps they would be viewed as two people. And if it was a person who has an extra head, there's essentially one person sharing sensations, and that would be more, in the eyes of this discussion, as one person. And the later literature comes up a little bit more, in the, mostly in the 17th century and the 18th century, the Shubits of the Shtos Yaakov, which are reproduced in that package, and the commentary. Uncle Joseph Shaul Nathanson is one of the great poskim in his drama and his approbation to the Tshuva, and the Tshuva Parashas Ketanos around the same time, both report incidences of conjoined twins and discussing exactly how they viewed, and the Shvat Yaakov and others both strongly take the position that we're talking about two separate people here, and that it's not such a new concept. As he points out, the Talmud tells us in the Sefer Zeirin that actually Adam and Chava goes back to the very beginning of creation, that actually Adam and Chava were created as conjoined twins, as two people attached as one, and were then later separated, and that, if you look carefully at the Pesukim, you can see why that's a reading of the Pesukim in the beginning of creation. So this idea goes back all the way that far, and clearly Adam and Chava constituted two people, and he brings this point to make the conclusion that really these twins are viewed as two people for purposes of inheritance and for all kinds of other purposes. Even though there are tremendous complexities, the questions that come up as far as marriage. Marriage might be an intractable problem depending on exactly the circumstances that he and others discuss. And there is a significant literature about that, and much of it is included in that package as far as this basic determination as to whether we're dealing with one person or two. And of course, in a modern context, the conjoined twins that we speak about are more readily recognized as two separate people with two separate nervous systems, perhaps two separate almost everything, and just joined at one point. There are cases, of course, which may vary, and the literature abounds with all types of different permutations, as we heard about. So the question that now comes to our attention tonight, and that's been more recently the issue, is the question of performing surgery to separate these two twins, and the risks that are inherent in such a procedure. And as we've heard referred to, there was a very celebrated case in 1977 which involved the intervention of Moshe Feinstein, involving a religious couple from Lakewood, New Jersey. There are many very prominent personalities involved in this story. As we've heard tonight, the surgeon who later became the Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. C. Edward Koop, and others were involved in the story as well, as we'll discuss. And there the situation was, very briefly speaking, that there were two baby girls called Baby A and Baby B, who shared a heart, who joined the gut region, and a heart with six chambers. It was not enough to sustain for a long time both together. The long-time prognosis was very, very bleak. They would not be able to hold out with one heart for such a long time. But it would be impossible to divide those hearts into two fully functioning hearts. To have a six-chambered heart divided into two, among all the other issues, was not practically possible. So essentially the question that was dealt with is it permissible, is it appropriate to sacrifice essentially one child in order to give the other one a hope of survival? And everyone involved was very, a lot of religious people involved here, a lot of ethical people involved here, they were all deeply concerned about what this case represented. And the newspaper stories that appeared in the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer and other news outlets at the time tell us that many of the nurses who were Catholic opted out of the procedure, felt it wasn't something they could partake in. And Dr. Koop was very concerned about the religious implications, also very concerned about the legal implications. He was afraid that perhaps charges could be brought against him for murder if he participated in the surgery, if he performed the surgery. And he sought in advance that the court should give him an order of protection, that he shouldn't be prosecuted. He was represented in that by Arlen Specter, that he became senator. And the question was then brought both by the couple, who was a couple of young Talmud Chacham, running in Lakewood, and apparently from the reports that Dr. Koop was also looking for this authority as well, that Rav Moshe Feinstein, together with his family, with Dr. Tendler, and with his grandchildren, and with other experts, spent quite a long time, many nights, with hours and hours, pondering this issue before coming to the conclusion that the twins should indeed be separated. And sadly, after the separation was done, one of the twins died a matter of weeks later, where the first twin died immediately, and the other twin died only a few weeks later, so unfortunately it was not successful in the long term. But the motion decision was to separate the twins, and that was done. And as Mr. Wasserman stated, it wasn't much of a dispute among the parties involved. There was no parental challenge. They had all followed this ruling. It was a motion that got a lot of attention at the time. And very surprisingly, perhaps, Rav Moshe did not publish his reasoning and his written works in his Tshuva Sigrus Moshe, and in a sense that's fortunate and unfortunate for us as far as our ability to analyze this issue. It's unfortunate for us that we don't have a first-hand representation of what he's thinking was, although we have very close to it. We have the way Dr. Tendler's account, which Rav Tendler was very involved in the story. And on the other hand, the reason it's in a sense fortunate is because it gave many other writers who came afterwards the opportunity to hypothesize about what are the possible rationales for such a conclusion. And that has, in a sense, generated a richer literature for us to work with as far as figuring out what exactly might be the thought process behind such a decision. So I'd like to just now briefly look at some possible models how something could come to this conclusion. Perhaps you might say there are 6 or 7 models for one to decide that the surgery should indeed be performed. And of course the circumstances are going to vary greatly from situation to situation. Every set of facts is different, and it's looking off the vantage point of this case that the Moshe was involved with. So first of all, one question to be dealt with is the question that we mentioned at the very beginning, the question of are we dealing with one person or are we dealing with two people? Because if it could be ascertained that we're dealing essentially with one person, the question in contemporary literature also that we find that Moshe Steinbach has the truth about this, and the Rabbi Yitzchak Halpern has discussion about this, I think it's in the packet as well. So then the question becomes a much simpler one. If we're dealing essentially with one person, so one person cannot sacrifice a limb in order to guarantee long-term survival. And the question is far less complex. However, it's very unlikely that that's the case in the cases that we're dealing with. We can say pretty much with certainty in the cases that we're talking about that's not really the situation. We have 2 distinct nervous systems and more significantly 2 distinct consciousnesses, 2 distinct awarenesses. So it's very hard to say that we're talking about one person, even if such a case could come up. So eventually we have to assume that we're dealing with 2 people, and therefore, of course, it becomes much more complicated because we're dealing with the potential murder of the twin who wouldn't survive. So if that's the case, we have to look towards another model. And perhaps the first model that might come up, looking towards a second possibility, the first thought we might have would be the concept of rogue, that we know that if somebody is chasing after someone else and trying to kill that person, so then that person has the status of a rogue, and either the person who's being pursued or a third party who sees what's going on is allowed to and is actually obligated to kill that person if he can't do it in any other way. If he can save him in a less lethal way, then he's supposed to do that. But if the only option is to kill the person who's pursuing, so then that's what has to be done. And perhaps that might be a model that might be looked at here. Now, there are obvious problems with that model. The problem isn't necessarily the fact that the person who's the potential rodent here doesn't have evil intent, because that's not necessarily required for rodent. The rodent doesn't necessarily have to come as a murderer, as an intentional evil murderer, so to speak. It could be that he's just trying to save his own life. He might still qualify as a rodent. We find in some of the literature, in the Tendon's piece and in others, the example of a person who jumps out of a plane. Let's say 2 people jump out of a plane, and one finds his parachute doesn't work, and the other one has a parachute that works. So the one without the parachute latches on to the one who does have the parachute, and he's pulling him down. He's trying to save his life, but in doing so, he's pulling down the person with the parachute. Now, the person who has the parachute has to decide if he's about to kick away the other person, if he's about to knock him and send him to his death in order to save his life. So there, the assumption is pretty much automatically presented there that that's permissible, because there you have a clear road date. You have a clear person who's taking an action which is endangering the life of another. Even though this person, this road date here, is not evil, he's trying to save his own life, nonetheless, that clearly portrays him as a pursuer, and that might identify him as a road date. However, it's difficult to apply this in such a case here, besides the fact that we're not just talking about a lack of evil intent, we're talking about a lack of any intent at all. There's no active involvement, no active awareness in what you're doing. And also, perhaps more significantly, it's hard to necessarily identify as one the pursuer and one the pursued. It's one the road base and one the near death. That's a far more difficult question, and was highly relevant to the 1977 question. As the reports tell us, Feinstein repeatedly sent a message to Dr. Koop, are you sure that one baby is the one that has the viability, that essentially has the heart, and the other one is the one that's infringing on the heart? Could we equally say that the heart could be placed in either body? And Dr. Koop was very confident that really only one baby, so to speak, owns the heart, and the other baby was the one that was imposing upon the heart. David Weiss, who has an essay about this, which is also printed in the packet, is very unsure about whether that really was correct. Even if the heart is located closer to one's body, doesn't necessarily imply ownership of the heart. There's no other way to figure out who owns the heart. it's just the logical path to say that they share the heart, that there's one six-chambered heart that was shared. So therefore, to identify one as the pursuer and one as the pursued is far more difficult, and the general principle that we have, that Rabbi Akiva Eiger and others point out, is that if the two people are pursuing each other, so then we don't really have the right for a third party to get involved, and it becomes far more complicated. So a third model we could possibly look at is the model of abortion, and the abortion literature. And here we find a very mysterious passage in the Talmud, and an even more mysterious passage in the Rambam, and as far as telling us why it is that abortion is required in the case where the mother's life is threatened. And some of these facts and some of the ideas that come out of that discussion may or may not be useful for this, depending on how we understand it, and there's quite a lot to be said about that. So just very briefly, the Talmud tells us very clearly in Mishnah Nogos, which is quoted in the Gemara Mishnah Sanhedrin, that if a mother is about to give, mother has not yet given birth, and she's in great distress, so then the pregnancy has to be terminated in order to save the mother. However, if the baby has already been born, if the head has already come out, the baby is already alive, so to speak, has already been born, so then the Talmud says that ain't okay nefesh mitzvah nefesh, that we don't have the right to say we're going to choose one life over another life. We don't have the right to say we're going to prefer this life, and that's the one we're going to choose. The Talmud then asks, well, what about the category of rodeis? This baby is essentially chasing after the mother, essentially causing a pursuit to happen against the mother. The Talmud says, no, that's not really what's going on. Has this mysterious expression that Mishamaya Karad Kaleh, that it's the heaven that's doing the pursuit here, that it's the natural circumstance, basically God who's the rodeis. And the baby doesn't have that status. It's now two lives both struggling for life, and we don't have the right to choose one over the other. Now that in itself is a little bit cryptically stated, but the Rambam makes it even more confusing. And the Rambam phrases it a little bit differently. The Rambam seems to invoke the principle of rodeis in explaining this Talmudic concept of abortion. And the Rambam basically formulates it that before the baby is born, so then the baby is kirodeh, the baby has a status comparable to a pursuer, apparently invoking the principle of rodeh even to explain abortion, which itself is a chiddush, because one could have said otherwise that maybe it's just a question of the lack of complete status of life. So the Rambam seems to be invoking a new concept here by bringing in this idea of rodeh. And then, once the baby is already born, so even though the rodeh concept should still be equally apparently equivalent, then the Rambam says, no, we're not going to do it, because that's Kibbutz Shalom, this is the nature of the world, this is the way the world works, different people are competing for space, they're competing for resources, and we don't have the right, so to speak, to kill one to save the other. So there's a lot of discussion about what the Rambam means by this, about what we can glean from these principles in order to try to understand any further question. See, my parents are here tonight, my father in his book in Birth Control and Jewish Law, list, I believe, 13 approaches in the Afronim how to explain this Rambam. So there's a lot to say that I'm not going to try to say any of them tonight, really. But what we can glean from the Rambam's formulation and from the Talmud itself is very hard to figure out. So Rabbi Kandler, in his report of what happened here, so he discusses that Rambam as pretty much the core basis of Moshe's thinking. And he basically understands that in both situations, pre-birth and after-birth, we're essentially dealing with two people, and that there's a general Rizifa situation going on, except that the two people are both struggling for life under natural circumstances. So why is it that it's allowed before the baby's born? If they're essentially the same, why should we allow it before the birth takes place? So there he explains the factor that gives the mother's life the edge is the fact that the mother is the source of life, the fact that the baby depends upon the mother to survive. So that's why we give an edge to the mother's life, and that's why it's treated that way. And after the baby's born, it can live on its own, it's independent, so there's no longer that factor. So they found the right, and if that's the issue, so perhaps that could be applied here, specifically in this case, if we identify one of the two babies as being basically viable on its own, and the other baby as being close to parasitic, or really drawing away from the life force of the other one, so then we can see it as a baby in utero, we can see it as an unborn baby who is dependent upon the mother for life, and therefore the edge is given to the mother, so too here the edge is given to the more valuable baby, to the more complete baby, so to speak, and that is the way the Talmud explains how Moshe came to his conclusion. And indeed we find other models as well. Another model is discussed in much of the literature, and the Talmud discusses this but does not favor for reasons that we'll talk about. There's a well-known passage that really appears in the Talmud Yerushalmi and Rashi and the Sefer Sanhedrin, and the discussion about abortion references it, that the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us at more length, that if you have a group of Jews, and then let's say a group of bandits comes and attacks them and says that we want to kill somebody, They give us somebody, give us one of your number, and we'll kill them. So then the halakha is that one is not permitted, a group is not permitted to turn over a person to be killed. And even though this means that they're all going to be killed, even though this means that the bandits are going to kill all of them, still they're not permitted to do this. The prohibition against murder, against handing somebody over for death, is binding, and they're not allowed to do this even to save all of their lives. This is an example of the principle the Talmud has, that murder is the yehareg bal yavor, that one has to allow themselves to be killed rather than to kill somebody else. However, there are circumstances in which it's permitted, and it's based on a passage in the Bible and Shmuel Beis, without going into details in the interest of time, but basically the rule is that if these marauders don't simply say, give us one person, but they name somebody, they say, give us so-and-so, we designate, we're after so-and-so, that's the one we want, so give us so-and-so so we can kill him, so then the Talmud seems to say that it's permitted to give over that person. That person is considered to be designated for death, as Rashi explains under there in Sanhedrin, because the person is going to die anyway, so you're not really going to make a difference by holding on to him a little bit longer. But there is a very significant issue which may stop this from being relevant here. If we stop there, it might very well be a good source, because we could say that since both babies would die without the surgery, and certainly the weaker baby would die anyway, so to turn over the weaker baby in the case of the surgery should on the surface be comparable to that situation. Here we said it's as if the bandits came and said, turn over that one, so the rest of you will live. So on the surface, that seems to be a very comparable model. However, the problem is, and this might be a significant problem, is that there's actually a debate over there in the Talmud as to whether or not that's enough. The view of the Gelfin is that's enough. As long as they ask for somebody, you can turn over that person. But the view of Reish Lakish is that the person can't be an innocent person. He has to be a guilty person. He has to have done something which makes him guilt, which makes him deserving of being executed. If he's an innocent person, the fact that they named him doesn't allow you to turn him over. So that might be a very big impediment to using this as a source. It could be that if that's the requirement, so then this baby's not guilty of anything, didn't do anything in order to be designated for death, and therefore that might not be a significant enough source. That may not be a sufficient source. So the problem is, what do we passim like? Do we follow the view of the Yochanan? Do we follow the view of Reish Lakish? So of course, it depends on yes. If I'm not focused around in the Sefer follows the view of the Yochanan, and the Rambam follows the view of Reish Lakish, that it has to be somebody who is guilty, and the Rambam of course both opinions. So we don't know exactly how to rule it. The problem is basically unresolved in a matter of murder, a matter of capital law. So we're not going to be lenient, we're not going to be cavalier about choosing between these two opinions. So therefore, as most posts will point out, it's very difficult to use this source to rely upon under normal circumstances. So that we have another model, so there are a few other models we could mention as well. With Aristotle Polarski, he's one of the Rosh Yeshiva and Kamevich, I believe his piece is included in the packet as well. So he writes that the Rav Moshe had issued this ruling that the surgery could take place, and he doesn't know why it was. So he had heard that it was because of Rodeis. So he mentions that Rodeis is a little bit of a difficult principle to use, because as we know, the Talmud in discussion about abortion says that once a baby is born, so then ain dof nefesh mipnei nefesh, that you can't kill one person to save another. So if that's the case, here we're dealing with babies that are already born, babies that have already come out to the world, so how can we use the concept of Rodeis here? So the Baruch Pavarsky, he suggests that really we have to come from a whole different approach. We can use a whole different model. And that maybe we could say that it's not about Rodeis, and it's not about this Gemara about handover and handing over a person. It's a whole different idea. That really the idea is that we have a concept called a nato. That if you have a baby that's not able to survive 30 days, a baby that was born in a state that it's not really viable, so then there are certain halachas that apply to it, but it doesn't. There's no mourning that's associated with it. It doesn't have the status of a fully viable human being, and it's not something that's permissible. It's not permissible to kill, but it has a whole different status as far as how it's going to rank. So therefore, we can more easily understand that a nato could perhaps be sacrificed in order to save a viable child. But okay, but here we're dealing with babies that are more than 30 days old, so how do they fit into the category of a nato? How can we apply that terminology here? So here he suggests that we have to expand the definition, that if we have technology, for example, that will keep the baby alive longer, if the baby by itself would have lasted only 30 days, or less than 30 days, then that baby could still be a nato, even if it lives much longer, but through artificial support. So since this baby has to rely on the other baby that it's connected to for all of its life functions, so therefore it's essentially a nato, because by itself it couldn't have survived 30 days. So therefore, even though it's now alive at an older age,
it still has the status of an AFL, so when you're ranking it against the viable child takes precedence. But I'd like that his analysis does not really approve of this approach, because he quotes that really the halachic literature tends to go in the other direction. So when you have babies that are in incubators, babies that really could not have survived without external life support systems, and they're alive for more than 30 days, so the halachic literature has pretty much across the board not considered these children to be considered in the category of NAFL, as far as the halachic decision at Ben, as far as career, as far as mourning rights, as far as all of that, and therefore he feels the literature doesn't really support this approach from that perspective. So there are perhaps other models that can be used, but there are other sources that kind of do support this idea of either a NAFL being the dominant factor, or perhaps the idea of a tracer. If a tracer, the person who does not necessarily have a condition from birth, but at any point develops a condition where he's not going to live more than a year, so that person also sometimes we find that his status is a little bit different. It's not permissible to kill a tracer, but a tracer, if one does kill a tracer, he's not liable for the death penalty. The status of the crime is a little bit different. And the Meiri, in his commentary from the Sefer Sanhedrin, as Father Cohen recently mentioned to a friend of mine, the Meiri writes in his commentary to the Sanhedrin that the discussion about turning over somebody to the bandits, the group of bandits, normally if they say, give us somebody, so you're not allowed to just give them somebody. But if the person happens to be a tracer, the person happens to be somebody who's going to die anyway, so then the Meiri has a very big footage that one could turn over the tracer to this band of marauders. And it's a very controversial point, and the Behuda has a lengthy debate in his response between him and the Rishaya Tik Berlin in general about whether we ever view the life of the tracer as having any different status as far as ranking a person who's going to die in the near future. Do we treat him any differently? And the Behuda said it very much that's not the case. So if you look at the footnotes in the bottom of the Meiri, so he asserts that the Meiri doesn't mean to say at all that you're permitted to kill a tracer. He means to say that in this circumstance, if you're not actually killing, who knows, maybe they'll turn him over and maybe they're going to run away. Maybe he'll figure out a way to escape before he actually gets killed. It's not actually killing him. So that's why we'll give a little bit of an edge to a tracer. And this really is something that you find other literature about as well, that as much as we justifiably feel very uncomfortable ranking any two lives against each other in this sense, this is something that Mr. Wasserman was discussing, so you do find some discussion of ranking a tracer a little bit differently than a viable life. And just to make it a little bit more palatable, we're not really talking about one person's life being worth more than another person's life, but we're talking about, let's say, the life being generally equivalent, but if one life is going to last and one life is not, then perhaps there is a basis to see those two lives as different, even though, of course, there's a tremendous slippery slope there also. You could say, well, maybe I should sacrifice a 95-year-old person to save a 2-year-old person. But here we're talking about something different than actuarial possibilities. We're talking about actual lack of viability, and that might perhaps make a significant difference. So this is perhaps a fifth model that we could deal with, but maybe there is a difference when we're talking about a life that's essentially less viable, whether we call it an AFL like with Dr. Barsky, or whether we call it a tracer. Maybe that would suggest a significant difference. So a fifth model that we could use is the model that Rabbi Bleist prefers in his essay, and he points out that Moshe Feinstein himself wrote this in other discussions, not in discussion about the conjoined twins, but elsewhere, that the interpretation of the passage that we're talking about the two people who are about the band that's saying, the band is saying turn over somebody. So why is it that you're able to, why is it that according to one opinion you can turn over somebody who's named, and according to another opinion you can turn over as long as he's guilty or something? So Moshe explains over there that essentially what we have is we have really two different types of relief to go now. We have two different types of pursuits. But on the one hand, this is really within the group of people. So the group of people want to turn over this guy to be killed because it will save their lives, so they're pursuing him. And he's pursuing them because his presence among them is causing all of them to be at risk. There's a mutual pursuit going on. And as we mentioned before, if there's a mutual pursuit, so then we don't really have a way to figure out who wins, and you're not really supposed to be involved. However, one could assert, as emotion apparently does, that that would be true if everything were equal. But if there is a reason to rank the two differently, if there is a reason to say that one has an edge over the other, then perhaps we could give an edge to one group over the other. And here, what's he depriving the group of? He's depriving the group of their lives. He's putting their lives at risk. What are they depriving him of? Not really of his life, because his life is going to end anyway, as Rashi points out. Depriving him of temporary life he'll have for a few minutes or for a few hours until they're able to infiltrate the whole group and to get him. So if we call a chayisha, it's a temporary life. So when the two mutual pursuers are not equal, the one is looking to protect his long-term life and the other is looking to protect a temporary life, a life that's not viable in any sense of the word, so then we could legitimately give an edge
to the long-term life, and perhaps that was what Moshe was utilizing in this case here also, that they could be viewed as mutual pursuers. The two babies are essentially pursuing each other, but since one is going to be viable, so one could potentially be risking his life, his long-term life, and the other is risking short-term life, maybe one can give an edge to the more viable baby. So also just mention one final model, which is not cited in this literature, that might perhaps be relevant. There is a discussion that many secular philosophers use as a model. Dr. Shaftel, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe there's an extensive literature about this. Let's say you have a situation where you see there's a missile coming towards a group of people. And you have the ability to deflect the missile. If you're going to deflect the missile, so the missile will kill one person. So you will decide to cause that one person's death, and in doing so, you're going to save a whole group of people from death. So recently, Kwame Adney appeared in his book, Ethics, Experiments and Ethics, discusses this at length. Again, correct me if I'm wrong. So this is a discussion that philosophers talk about. The Chazanish talks about this as well. The Chazanish, in his basis, the Sanhedrin had a discussion of this with Usher Weiss in this year, and is very fond of the Chazanish. He says, this statement of the Chazanish is a proof that the Chazanish was a throwback. Chazanish was a Rishon. He wasn't an Akron. He was a Rishon living in 1950. And the Chazanish in his paper in Sanhedrin says that it's permissible to move the missile. It's permissible to create the situation where there's one other person who is safe, is going to die, and save the other group of people. Because what are you doing? You're not committing murder. You're committing an act of saving. You're committing an act of hatzalah. So since your act is not an aggressive act, even though it's going to result in someone's death, but it's an act of saving, so therefore it becomes permissible, and therefore something we're allowed to do. So that could perhaps be very relevant here, that even though essentially what's happening is you're causing the death of one baby, but the action is not an act of aggression, it's an act of saving. You're acting purely to save the life of the other baby. And that act will result in the death of another baby. Perhaps it's comparable to this case of moving the missile away from one group and going to a smaller casualty camp, that the thrust of the act is an act of hatzalah, is an act of saving, and therefore maybe that could also be a model in order to make it permissible. So there's a lot more to discuss in this case. It's really just working off of the case that Moshe has dealt with, but of course the cases can get even more complex. One could presume that it's a situation where not that it was automatic death for the other baby, but it was a reduced odds of survival, that would probably be included within much of these cases. But again, the fact that we have many different cases gives us many different hypotheses as to what Moshe was thinking benefits us in allowing us to have a different model to think from. The cases could become even more complex if the twins have grown up and are now deciding on their own whether they want to take the surgery, or if there's perhaps a debate between the two of them as to whether or not the surgery should take place. Then the issues are opening up a whole new Pandora's box of questions, which really draw upon further discussions, which are really out of the scope of what we're able to discuss tonight. As Mr. Wasserman pointed out, it's really the basis for a whole other discussion. But I will just end by saying that I think when we look at this question from a religious perspective and we look at it from a secular perspective, there might be a little bit of a different vantage point between the two, that even if we come to very similar conclusions, that the method of thinking is a little bit different. Because religion has the benefits of believing that essentially that God is running the world, and that it's not really the responsibility of the religious person to make the world work. It's the responsibility of the religious person to behave properly. While a secular government may not necessarily have that same perspective. They have the perspective that it's our responsibility to ensure the welfare of the people, and therefore our laws are there to make sure as many people are as well off as possible. And therefore, how we will define a concept such as murder or something related to that is going to be working off of that type of thinking. What's best for the society as a whole? What's the best definition of murder that's going to make society work? While a religious perspective is more behavioral in nature, it has to say that I have my responsibility to do what God wants me to do. I want a world that's going to be as well off as possible. That's part of God's commandment to me. And that's, we have this tremendous mandate to heal. We have this tremendous emphasis on saving life. That's all part of the behavioral system. So that's all used to define how we behave. But ultimately, we have the ability to look at it, so we have to define what are our commandments, what are our obligations, and with the knowledge that ultimately God is controlling the world, and it's more our responsibility to know how to behave and how to carry out His chokhmah than to come at it from any other perspective. So basically, just to very briefly recap, we saw that there was much discussion in literature as far as whether we're dealing with one person or two people, and that's perhaps relevant to the question of whether the separation can take place. And we looked at seven models as to why perhaps the Moshe may have come to this conclusion that the surgery could take place. Do we see it because we look at it as one person and therefore sacrificing a limb? Do we say that it's rodeis, that essentially it's a pursuer situation, but there's all the difficulties with that? Do we look at the model of abortion, which perhaps yields some insight into how we adjudicate these types of questions in general? Do we look at the model of give over one person who may be designated for death or perhaps liable for death, depending on which view is the norm of the view? And is that the operative model here? do we see it as a question that the less viable baby is either a nasal or a tracer, and therefore perhaps on some level their lives can be ranked in a different sense? Or do we look at the situation, like what Beck put it, as a situation of mutual pursuers, but since they are unequal as far as their long-term viability, that allows us to intervene in a mutual pursuit situation? Or do we perhaps take the view that the Fatimish expressed in another context, that even something that will result in someone's death, if it's primarily an act of hatzalah, an act of life saving, then that might be permissible. And again, the issue is beyond all of us, but we can only hope that through our continued efforts of nights like these, to try to glean as much as we can from all the different perspectives that our sources give us, that hopefully we should be able to act properly and justly through the wisdom of the God. Thank you very much.
I want to thank all the speakers, and now the floor will be open to questions. You can go up and thank any of the three speakers.
This one is for Dr. Weinberg. Based on improvements in stem cell technology, especially I know the research lab at Einstein, and I found that stem cells can help regrow degenerative and damaged nerve tissue. Could they be used theoretically or practically in the separation of conjoined limbs and for regrowing, if you have to regrow nerves or whatever? Could these be used because they have a large impact?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all the medical research that over the next century or so, probably conjoined twins will resolve, and that issues such as the Lakeford twins in the 70s were no longer a major problem, because nowadays having a baby to survive with two chambered heart is not for shattered. We operate the twins in our babies with single ventricle. I think, you know, with the advances in medical research, some of the issues we deal with would be dealt with in the past that were no longer resulting.
So that means that if you had six chambered heart in a string, what was the anatomy of the heart that had two bicuspid valves that shared two radiations? How was the anatomy of
the heart? I don't know the specifics, but most of the time it's a single ventricle,
provides blood flow. Could you just answer for another one? In the case of my, for example, the Mitchell, when the person is dead, I don't feel sincere. People are trying to kill them, those people in check for them.
That's a very important question. I should first point out, by the way, that Fatimish's approach, as the Russian White Woman has done, is body mind garden, is very, very innovative, and it's not at all clear that others would agree with that approach. It's absolutely to emphasize that. And it would seem that presumably the person would have the right to have the right thing, right, self-defense, because others have the right to try to defend themselves. So it could indeed result in a clash of priorities, but the one doing this has the right to choose to save others in any way he sees appropriate. And the one who now finds his life threatened has the right to do what he needs to do in order to try to survive. And it's that act of conflict that very logically probably would result in that. But again, I should point out that it's not necessarily unanimous that everyone would even agree what such an action is, and that's what we're dealing with.
This is our also for Rabbi Sonkin. In the culture with the population, the parallel that we drew between them in terms of missile. In the case of the missile, however, I know that you pointed out that there's a group of people, and the group of people versus the one individual who had died. So it doesn't matter that there were a lot of people, because it's not an exact parallel in this case, where there's just
Absolutely. It absolutely matters. And I'll try to be quick to ask, I have to apologize, I unfortunately have to give another two, so I'm going to run out after and try and answer this question. But it very much is important. The reason that it parallels here is because essentially, the lack of a better term, the math is similar. That they were talking about saving a group of people in order to, killing one person to save a group of people. Here, the assumption is that both things will not divide. So it's essentially a question of saving nobody or saving one person. So the numbers do vary in both cases, and that's correct.
Thank you.